Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Jane Mayer is the co-author of two best-selling narrative nonfiction books, Landslide, The Unmaking of the President, and Strange Justice, The Selling of Clarence Thomas. She's a Washington-based staff writer for The New Yorker, specializing in political and investigative reporting. Before that, she was senior writer and front-page editor for the Wall Street Journal, as well as the journal's first female White House correspondent. She was also a war correspondent and a foreign correspondent for the paper. Among other stories, she covered the bombing of the American barracks in Beirut, the Persian Gulf War, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the final days of communism in the Soviet Union. She was nominated twice by the journal for a Pulitzer Prize in the feature writing category. Before joining the Journal, she worked as a Metropolitan reporter for the Washington Star and began her career in journalism as a stringer for Time magazine while still a student in college. She's also written for a number of other publications. We have Jane Mayer to thank for chronicling the Bush administration's grim and furtive dealings with torture. How else would we ever have heard or even dreamed of such techniques as learned helplessness or random maltreatment? In her book, The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals, a title which really says it all, we learn the drama behind the struggle within the Bush administration over torture. She'll talk about The Dark Side tonight with John Wiener, one of our favorite Allowed interlocutors, who is a contributing editor to The Nation magazine, a professor of history at UC Irvine, where he specializes in recent American history. His books include Historians in Trouble, Plagiarism, Fraud, and Politics in the Ivory Tower, Give Me Some Truth, The John Lennon FBI Files, Professors, Politics, and Pop, and Come Together, John Lennon in His Time. I'm sure many of you know John's afternoon drive time radio program on KPFK 90.7 FM, and we're very happy to have him here tonight. And please welcome Jane Mayer and John Wiener to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
Thanks to everybody for coming. We have a sort of a terminological issue to start with. What do we call this phenomenon that your book is about? President Bush and Vice President Cheney called it enhanced interrogation techniques. I looked up enhanced in the dictionary and I brought in the definition. Enhanced means intensified in value or beauty. Let's take, for example, waterboarding. There's that one detainee named Abu Zubaydah who was waterboarded how many times? 187, I think, something like that? 183?
He was 83, and then Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was 183.
All right.
Right. So,
Who says waterboarding is not torture, and who says it is?
Okay. You know, the thing that enhanced interrogation techniques, I was going to tell you, it was obviously a euphemism that they thought was an improvement on other possibilities. But in fact, if you translate it into German, it is apparently the same phrase that was used in World War II by the other side. So enhanced interrogation techniques actually has a pretty dubious history. But waterboarding, who calls it waterboarding? Who calls it torture?
Who calls it torture? Who says it is not torture?
Well,
and who says it is torture?
Our former vice president described it as a dunk in the water and said, you know, it was a no-brainer that it was a good idea to do it. The only problem was that even 10 years ago, a sheriff in Texas who tried doing it was convicted of a felony and sent away to prison for 10 years. So it's been considered really since at least 1901 to be torture and a major crime.
Considered by?
By our laws.
By our laws.
Right. Up until the Bush administration lawyers came in and redefined it. They redefined what torture was so that it was very hard to commit torture because they made the bar so high. I mean, and it required, it wasn't just the physical and psychological dimensions that they said you had to reach in order to commit torture, but they also said that you had to have the intent to cause grave pain and severe pain and suffering, and that if the severe pain and suffering were simply byproducts of your attempt to get the truth out of a prisoner rather than your specific intent, then that was not torture. So there were so many outs that they wrote into this law. It was, you know, complete Swiss cheese filled with loopholes. And that was the reason they wrote the laws that way. So,
well, one of the things I'm most interested in is your own experience in researching this book. You write about a lot of really terrible things that our country has done. Just tell us, for example, those three detainees who were killed, who you have written about recently, who died after being tortured, what exactly happened to them?
Gosh, I hope this audience is not preparing to have a dinner soon or something. It's not not the best thing for appetites. There was one in particular, Manadel El-Jamadi, who, according to the medical examiner, was crucified, which I never really knew what that meant exactly, how you die from that. But what they said was that because of the way he was hung up by his arms with collapsed ribs, that he couldn't breathe. So he suffocated, and the medical examiner said he was crucified. He had a hood over his head, too. And that was a case where this prisoner was marched into Abu Ghraib by the CIA at about 2 or 3 in the morning, and by dawn he was dead, and he was fine when he came in. So what happened to him is described as a homicide in the medical examiner's report. Yet, what was interesting to me, the question I had when I wrote this story for The New Yorker in the first place was, can the CIA get away with murder? Has anybody ever been prosecuted for murder in the CIA? The answer is that, as far as I know, nobody has ever been prosecuted for murder, and nobody was in this case either. The CIA's inspector general did a report, thought there was a probability that a major crime was committed. They sent the details to the Justice Department, which at the time was under the leadership of Alberto Gonzalez, and somehow no charges were ever brought against anybody. So that was one of the cases.
So you spent a lot of time kind of digging up the gruesome facts of what happened to dozens of people. What was it like for you to go to the dark side?
To live on the dark side. Well, it was pretty tiresome for my family, I think. I have a 16-year-old daughter who was sort of living through all of this and kind of saying, oh, Mom's upstairs writing about torture again. And, you know, it was a little bit odd, I guess, for them. But the truth is that, you know, the true confession of probably of every investigative journalist is that this kind of work is what we're made for. And there's sort of, in a strange way, it's completely exhilarating, truthfully, to find something so awful and to be able to nail it. And you feel you're playing a role that really matters in democracy. I really felt I want to get the word out to this country about what the government's doing in its name. And so it was really very exciting. It was almost also such a puzzle to try to figure out what we were doing, because there were just these little pieces of it, and they would click into place. And mostly, finally, when I put it together in a book, I could see the whole story, really. So, I mean, it sounds callous and terrible, but I can't say I was up there weeping. I was actually up there sort of thinking, oh, yeah, you know, this is an amazing story. So something people need to know.
I guess you're a professional is what we have
well,
to conclude.
It's like trauma surgeons. Yeah. It's not you don't wish for suffering, but, you know, it tests your skills.
Yeah. So I thought what we would do here is first talk about Cheney, and then later talk about Obama, sort of my plan here. And I guess we should start with the title, The Dark Side. Where does that come from?
That is a quote from our former Vice President Cheney. And it was actually, you know, pretty upfront about, he was fairly upfront in saying where we were headed. It was the first weekend after 9/11, and he went on Meet the Press with Tim Russert, and he said, in order to win the war on terror, we're going to have to work on the dark side and fight in the shadows. And he said that we have to use all means at our disposal. And he said, this is where these people fight. And so the gist was, if you really look back on it, I don't think anyone quite knew at the time, but you look back on it, and what he's saying is, you know, the ends justify almost any means, and we're going to come down to their level and fight it their way. We're not going to fight it the way America has in the past. We're not going to take the high road. This is how these people fight. And so the actual quote tells you a lot, but I don't think we really knew at the time.
So when Cheney was vice president and you were working on this book, he was one of the hardest to find people in Washington. He spent a lot of time in that secure, undisclosed location. Since January 20th, he's been unstoppable. What was it he said last month about Obama's policy banning torture? What did he call it?
Recklessness cloaked in righteousness.
Recklessness cloaked in righteousness. So what do you make of Cheney's transformation here?
Well, you know, actually his daughter said something very interesting that I don't think people have noticed that much, which was that what really got him speaking out was the talk of possible prosecutions. Mm-hmm. And when he heard that, he thought he really needed to come out swinging and basically push the whole debate back again. And I don't think it was just because he was worried about his own status legally, but I think that he felt that there were an awful lot of other people who followed his orders who he thought were going to be potentially liable. So he came out here to try to defend them partly. And then I think also just, you know, basically it's a political gambit. I mean, he's kind of setting Obama up, really, so that if there is another attack, he can come out and say, you see, I told you so. It's because you didn't torture people. And, you know, it obviously, I mean, you're a professor, so you know that the logic there is filled with flaws, but just the same, he's kind of laying the groundwork politically, I think.
So let's go back a little bit here. The you say in The Dark Side that the CIA was told by its its own experts early on that many of the detainees at Gitmo were not the worst of the worst. It's one of the most interesting things in your book. And what's the story here, and what did Bush and Cheney do with that information?
Yeah, I'm glad you picked up on that, because I thought that was astounding, which is that in the summer of 2002, very early on, the Pentagon and the White House was having a very hard time getting good intelligence out of the people down in Guantanamo. And so they were confounded about why this was. And so they asked someone who I can't name, but he's a CIA expert in terrorism and he's fluent in Arabic. They asked him to go down to Guantanamo and do some interviews with some of the prisoners and find out, you know, what the problem was. And he came back and he said, I've got bad news for you. The reason you're getting bad intelligence is you've got the wrong people. And he said, and he told top people in the White House that probably 20% of the people down in Guantanamo were really terror suspects. And a great number of them were sort of wannabes and followers and minor figures. And then also a great number of them, he said, and I interviewed him, were just people who were in the wrong place at the wrong time and people who were sold into it by bounty hunters. So what interested me was that this information reached the White House counsel, who at the time was Alberto Gonzalez. It reached Vice President Cheney's top lawyer, David Addington, who would have shared it with Cheney. And they were forewarned. that 80% of the people that the United States was holding down there were potentially innocent, or at least wrong, shouldn't have been there. And the reaction of David Addington was to say, the president says they're enemy combatants, we're not going back on this. And they didn't want to open up any kind of investigation to look into it. And so we held on to many of these people for years and years. Obviously, now we've begun to sort of filter some of them out. But I thought it was, inside the White House, there were some lawyers. John Bellinger, who was the lawyer for the National Security Council, was in these conversations, and he was sort of saying, you know, what kind of country are we becoming if we're holding people who might be innocent with no way to get out? And he was simply considered a wuss and kind of ignored. Okay. So,
So these enemy combatants, some people said that they were covered by the Geneva Convention. The Bush administration was quite open in arguing that they aren't. The people in custody were not covered by the Geneva Conventions. What's your understanding of the Geneva Conventions? Who is covered and who is not?
Well, the Geneva Conventions cover pretty much any class of people who are involved in conflict, armed conflict. My understanding from interviewing a lot of international rights lawyers is that they were devised after World War II so that everybody had some kind of legal status, whether or not they are spies and saboteurs or civilians or proper soldiers. But what happened was that the Bush administration wanted to, they actually had conversations about this. They wanted to avoid being accused of committing war crimes very early on. And these were so they discussed this, and they thought if they said these people are not covered by the Geneva Conventions, then they couldn't be held as being in breach of the Geneva Conventions. So they basically just took this category of people outside of the law. They were not covered by the criminal laws, in their view, and they were not covered by the laws of war. They were simply people with no rights. And I actually got into this story at one point. One of the things that caught my attention was I went to hear John Yoo speak, who people might know as a fellow Californian.
He's a professor of law at Bolt Hall in Berkeley.
Right. And I heard him speak in a very small group at a think tank in Washington, a conservative think tank. And one of the things he said is, why do people have such a hard time understanding that there's a class of people that have no rights? They're just, he said they are like pirates, they're like slave traders, and terrorists have no rights. And I having, studied history at Yale and Oxford, I thought it was one of the scariest things I'd ever heard, that there could possibly be people in the view of America that had no rights, because, as we know, the Constitution and Bill of Rights begins with how we all have inalienable rights, and including the right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment. So it seemed to me to be a really radical approach that they had at that point. And there were very practical problems that flowed from it. That decision to take these people outside of any legal category, and particularly out of the Geneva Conventions, meant that they didn't do what's required in the Geneva Conventions. When you pick up possible prisoners of war under the Geneva Conventions, you have to give them something called Article 5 hearings, which means it's a really simple hearing. It happens on the battlefield, and you determine who's really a proper suspect and who's just cannon fodder that got caught up in it by mistake. And they didn't do those status hearings, which is how they wound up in Guantanamo with tons of people where they really didn't know who they were. They literally had people in Guantanamo, I discovered, for whom they didn't even know who their names were. They had files where they just had a number on it because they didn't know who they had, let alone what the people had done. So taking them outside of Geneva Conventions stripped people of the just the most fundamental kind of due process.
So is it fair to say the Geneva Conventions cover everybody?
Well, I mean, within armed conflict, yes, there's a category for everybody. There is a category that if you talk to human rights lawyers, the category that the terrorists, who are people who are illegal combatants, not proper soldiers, not in uniforms.
Right. War has not been declared. They're not wearing uniforms.
They are considered spies and saboteurs. And the rules were actually written after World War II, partly to cover the non-uniformed resistance fighters in World War II, so that they too would have some kind of rights. So it's okay. We have a very wonderful history in America of taking the high road in leading the world on what the laws of war should be and sort of defining the difference between warfare and just out and out barbarity. And that just got wiped out in this period.
So part of the dark side is about the horrible things that were done in the name of the United States and who did them and how they justified them. But another part of it is about who objected to this, who tried to stop it, who said it was wrong within the Bush administration, within the Republican Party. Let's talk about that a little bit. My favorite is John McCain.
John McCain. Well, he was essential, really, in turning the tide on Capitol Hill, and it was because he had, having been a war hero and having been tortured himself, nobody had more credibility on the subject. So for a while in Washington, when I was covering this, we were just sort of waiting for McCain to finally weigh in on this thing, and he actually went through, I think, a lot of kind of personal angst over whether to get into it or not, because he doesn't like to talk about it, and he doesn't like to make himself into a, just be seen as a torture victim. But anyway, he finally felt he had to step up to it, and I always loved what he said, which is really how I felt about this subject too, which is, it's not about them, it's about us.
It's not about them. It's about us.
It's about us. And this book, what I was trying to write about is about our country in the war on terror, not them. It's not to say that the terrorists were not terrorists, but it's what effect did they have on us as a country during this period.
So McCain organized a Senate resolution, was it? And there was a lot of lobbying against this by the Bush White House. What happened?
Cheney in particular. Yeah. They pushed very hard, and in fact, it's amazing how hard Cheney has fought to keep these enhanced interrogation techniques in circulation. I have to believe that he really, on some level, thinks that these things are necessary. It sort of fits in with his dark view of humankind. But
where did the Senate end up on this?
Well, they've gone back and forth in many different ways. They passed various resolutions, it's been a moving battle. It's still a moving battle. We're still dealing with this.
And who besides McCain, within the military, within the Bush White House, challenged the torture policies?
Well, really from the start. Another thing that really caught my eye as a reporter covering this was, from the start, there was this subject struck, I think, created crises of conscience in many, many people on the inside of the White House. The military were among the very first people to really take offense at what the Bush White House was doing. And they warned them that, for instance, that the military tribunals that were being set up dishonored the idea of military justice, because there really are procedures for doing these things, but they don't allow for using tortured evidence, for instance. The military has its codes of conduct, which train on the Geneva Conventions, so they know that you can't treat people in cruel and inhumane ways, and they didn't want to go along with this.
So let's name a few names here.
Well, one of my favorites was the top lawyer in the Navy, whose name is Alberto Mora, and he was the general counsel of the Navy, lifelong Republican, and when he learned about what was going down in Guantanamo, he thought there had to be a mistake, and then he discovered that in fact this was an authorized program, and that the lawyers in the Pentagon had authorized it. And at that point, he really tried to wage an internal battle. He took his arguments to the top lawyer in the Pentagon and to Rumsfeld himself. And he started warning them, among other things, that if you persist in this way, you may be accused of committing war crimes. And he warned them also that Rumsfeld would not be able to travel abroad. He said, you'll end up like Pinochet. So he did. They were forewarned. They cannot argue that they had not heard any of these legal interpretations. And the reason, I think it's always interesting to try to figure out, why do some people do the right things and some not? And in particular, I think the reason Mora was so sensitive to this was he has an unusual family history. He is the child of Hungarian immigrants who fled Nazism and then communism in Hungary. They moved to Cuba just in time to have Castro take over. They fled Cuba and moved to Florida. But they had very much alive in his family lore firsthand experience with tyranny and with cruelty. And so and Mora is very strong in saying, it doesn't matter if you call it torture or not. The point is, you cannot have a government, a state-authorized cruelty. The state cannot start using its might to hurt people and to force them into testifying against themselves. To him, the Constitution was a living, breathing document, not just a dead piece of history. So he got it right away, and he tried to warn them. And the sum total of his effort was that they decided to set up a study group on these issues. And then eventually he lost out and had to leave. So he left the government. But he's one of a number of great people. And that is another wonderful reason I wanted to write the book, was not just to describe all the awful things, but to describe the little acts of courage and big acts of courage that took place inside the government. And there was a quote that I came across that Hannah Arendt wrote in Eichmann in Jerusalem, where she talks about the responsibility of the writer, and she says, she talks about how tyrannical governments try to erase history, and that the responsibility of the writer is to go down the dark holes, restore the history, but not only write about what's wrong, but write about the few people who stand up and do what's right, so that we can pass that on to the next generation. So I thought I wanted to write about the people who do right.
It is one of the great things in the dark side.
Well, thanks.
This part. So if we take a big step back, you still have to wonder, why did they do all of this stuff? And there's two views of this. One is that after 9/11, Bush and Cheney and their team were genuinely frightened that 9/11 was only the beginning, and that there was more on the way, and therefore they had to go to the dark side. The other view is that Cheney in particular always had wanted to expand executive power, thought that the civil liberties had gone too far in the United States, and 9/11 gave him the opportunity to put into practice the goals he'd had for 10 or 20 years. Where do you stand in this debate?
I'd say both. What is
Which is more important?
Well, I mean, the thing is that 9/11 did give them the opportunity to act on their predispositions and the agenda that they already had. And there were no breaks on them. There was one party rule in Congress and for most of this time, and the courts were conservative, and the country was scared and complacent, and Congress was just completely supine and rolled over. So there was nothing to really stop them from moving ahead. And at the same time, Cheney was panicked. I mean, he literally thought he was going to die himself at one point. I tell the story in the beginning about how it was in October of 2001. He was exposed. There was a sensor went off in the White House in the Situation Room that was supposed to warn them if there were chemical or biological weapons there in the air. And it went off, and he thought he'd been personally exposed and was going to die. And
sounds like the smoke detector in my kitchen.
It's exactly that, because apparently what sets these alarms off is it's not bacon, it's perfume, and so among other things. And so it was a false alarm.
Love
them. But there was a while there though where he thought he was facing this, and they also thought, you know, if the United States was hit again, that they would be held politically, personally responsible. This was a tremendous
I want to ask
weight.
About that. Of course, their argument is that the fact that the United States has not been hit again shows that they have succeeded in protecting us. I wonder if you consider that a convincing argument.
Well, I mean, I think it would be more convincing if you could say that while these people were being tortured, they coughed up information about specific attacks that were coming our way that were stopped, but there's absolutely no evidence of that whatsoever. I mean, and I spend a lot of time talking to FBI agents and have said to them, well, how do you know that there were no attacks? And they were saying, well, there are no reports of them. There are no cell groups that were rolled up that they picked up around the world. You know, so there's no evidence that they stopped anything with this either.
How about those guys in Florida who were going to blow up the Sears Tower?
Well,
in
there
Chicago?
Is that, and the you
that
know,
it was pathetic. They had no plan.
I mean,
to
the
blow
thing
up
is,
the Sears Tower,
you know, Cheney's been saying recently that if the documents were released, all the documents were released by the government. It's wonderful that he's become an advocate for transparency.
I mean, <Yes.
laughs> finally on his side and vice versa. But that we would then see evidence that the torture program worked. You know, I've interviewed so many people who have seen the transcripts of these interrogations, including Jay Rockefeller, chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee at the time, who say not only is there no evidence that it worked, Rockefeller was convinced that it was a completely counterproductive program. So I have to believe that there are reasons that people who have seen this information feel that. And so I would like to see more of this released.
Okay, Obama.
Obama.
Obama. Obama campaigned against the torture policies, and in his inaugural address, he had some eloquent words with which you open your postscript. You remember what those? Remember what he said, or should I look this up? Obama said in his inaugural address, "We reject as false the choice between our safety and our ideals." Well, I want to look at some of his. The first thing he did was he announced his second day in office a bunch of new orders on the treatment of terror suspects, and he had that video shows him with a whole bunch of generals and admirals backing him up, literally. On this, remind us
again. These were the military figures took the lead in saying the torture's wrong for this country over and over again. It's not simply liberals and, you know, ACLU lawyers. It is the U.S. military has been dead set against this, and so has the FBI been. So they were there covering his back as he signed those executive orders, and they... You know, there are plenty of people who are very critical of Obama not doing more. But before we get to that, would really like to say that I think that, for me anyway, it was a wonderful moment to see that one of the first things he did was to ban torture, to say that we will respect the Geneva Conventions, which means there will be no cruel, unusual punishment, no inhumane treatment of people, no humiliation of prisoners in our custody. And he closed the black sites, you know, just like that. The end of the CIA's detention program.
And then he announced his appointments in the office once held by John Yoo. He appointed Dawn Johnson, a law professor who had called the torture memos an outrage.
She has yet to be confirmed.
That is my question. Where do we stand on Dawn Johnson today?
She has yet to be confirmed. I mean, the Republicans in the Senate have been holding her up, and you know, I think it's an outrage also that they haven't confirmed her. They only just confirmed last week a great human rights figure, Harold Koh, who's the dean of Yale Law School, who is going to be the top lawyer in the State Department. But he was named months ago. I mean, they were holding him up for
So what do you think is going to happen with Don Johnson? Dawn Johnson, you're a Washington reporter. Is this going to be stopped forever, or are they going to... Now that we have Al Franken on his way...
We now have Al Franken. I think the numbers are moving in the right direction for Don Johnson, finally.
So there can be a filibuster. Is that the way this works? There's a hold. First, any senator can put a hold on an appointment.
Anonymously. Right.
Anonymously.
Right.
And what does it take to take the hold off of somebody? Can 60 votes do that? You're our Washington reporter.
I don't think
reporter.
So. I don't think they can. No. I think that you have to figure out what the person with the hold wants. Basically. And
okay.
I would have thought she would be confirmed. She's been in the U.S. government before in very responsible positions. She's not a wild-eyed radical. I think part of what's holding her up also is that she had worked for NARAL, and that's really hit a nerve with some of the Republicans. So hopefully...
Then to head the CIA, Obama appointed Leon Panetta. He had written an article that was called... What was that one called?
No Torture, No
Excuses.
No Excuses, right.
That's the man Obama picked to... head the CIA. You interviewed him not too long ago. He's 70 years old. He has never worked in what they call intelligence. What's Leon Panetta like in this job?
Is that an oxymoron kind of quote thing? I don't know. I think they picked him. He was not the first choice. Interestingly, the man who was teed up to take that role as director of the CIA at first was someone named John Brennan, who was, as the blogosphere caught on to his background, there was a sort of great hue and cry that went up on the internet, because John Brennan turned out to have been chief of staff to the former director of the CIA during the height of the torture program. So he seemed pretty tainted and dubious as... it didn't seem like the change that we, had been working for, I guess. Who was Andrew Sullivan, one of the bloggers? He said, if you don't think we can stop him, we have one thing to say to you: yes, we can. And
the Daily Dish,
right? And so they did. And so Brennan actually has ended up in the White House, where he's advising Obama, nonetheless, on national security issues. But Panetta was a choice because he has a reputation for integrity, and he is seen as a bipartisan figure. He used to be a Republican, then he became a Democrat.
So you talked to him just like this.
I did talk to him.
What's his situation in the CIA at this point? He's an outsider.
I think it's tough. I mean, he is trying to lead the CIA into a better era, but many of the top people advising him were involved in the torture program. And because there's not ever been any kind of serious house cleaning or accountability, he's got people on his staff who were very much involved in this. He says that he thinks it's okay because many of them just expressed reservations internally and then did what they were asked to do. I don't know, that made me somewhat uncomfortable, but it's very hard, because if he turns on them now at this point and really tries to throw a lot of people out, he'll lose the support of the agency, and so it's a kind of a balancing act he's stuck in.
So the question that Obama has been confronted with since January 20th is, what kind of accountability should there be for the authors of the torture policy and maybe for the torturers? He has said repeatedly he thinks it's a mistake to look back, that we need to look forward.
Panetta actually wanted to look back. That's another interesting thing. Panetta told me, and it was news to me and to everyone else, I think, he wanted there to be some kind of truth commission, much as like Pat Leahy's been talking about, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. And I think for very smart reasons. Panetta has been in Washington a long time, and he basically said, you know, these questions just keep bubbling up, you know, things like, should we release the photographs? Should we release documents that show just shocking and incriminating bits of information? It would be so much better, Panetta thought, if we could delegate these questions to a nonpartisan, outside, independent board of, you know, that, like the 9/11 Commission, that would be studying it. And then Obama wouldn't have to answer for these things every single time the questions come up. Because as it is now, he's really stuck. I think Obama was hoping that there would be kind of neutral ground, but in truth, he's either got to open up the past or cover up the past. And he doesn't, you know, it's a terrible position to be covering up George Bush's mistakes. You know, I mean, it makes them his mistakes then. You know, he's going to have to answer for this. So it's a tough spot he's in, and I think that they should have probably gone for this Truth Commission thing. But they did not, because his political advisors saw this as toxic. You know, you start spending time on George Bush's problems, and you get bogged down in quicksand. And they wanted to move forward on their own agenda. They've got many things they want to do, healthcare and everything else, and they thought this might be a distraction.
So if we go with Obama here for a minute, and we've been looking back, but now let's look forward. One of the forward questions, of course, is, well, what should happen to the remaining detainees at Gitmo? Obama alarmed the civil liberties community in that speech at the National Archives a few weeks ago when he said he was considering making preventive detention an official policy of the United States. And then the Washington Post had an article, I think, earlier this week saying there was going to be an executive order to reassert presidential authority to incarcerate terrorism suspects indefinitely. Such an order would embrace claims by former President Bush that certain people can be detained without trial for long periods, close quote. You're a Washington reporter. Do you think Obama's going to become the first president in American history to introduce a preventive detention law?
Well, we do have preventive detention. It's the indefinite detention that's the problem. I mean, there's preventive detention, for instance, for John Gotti, who didn't get, was given no bail. He was held in preventive detention. We do that with people sometimes. So it's the problem is the indefinite detention, meaning you could hold someone for the rest of their lives without giving them a trial. I interviewed, among other people, the top lawyer in the White House, Greg Craig, the White House counsel, who said to me, and this was maybe 2 or 3 months ago, he couldn't imagine that Barack Obama would be the first president to do such a thing. But it's seeming more and more possible, and there's a fight going on inside the administration about just this. And, you know, I mean, these things, I don't want to cut him too much slack, because I think it's a terrible thing that we could do here. But I have a certain amount of sympathy also, because what he's dealing with, again, is George Bush's mistakes. And if anything tells you what a terrible mistake it was, it's that there's this population of prisoners down in Guantanamo whose rights have been so violated that even though they may be major terrorists, we can't put them on trial in a U.S. court, because the evidence against them has been wrung out of them through torture, and they've been coerced into testifying against themselves. And in any standard legitimate court, the cases would be thrown out. So it's you're dealing with this discrete population of potentially dangerous people whose rights have been violated. And meanwhile, on Fox TV, every 5 seconds, Obama's being bombarded with people saying, we can't even bring these people in the United States and put them in prison here, let alone let them free in case their rights were violated. So you can see what a jam they're in, and it is very much the unintended consequences of these Bush policies that Obama is stuck having to deal with. Just the same, then, I don't know how much people really want to hear about this, but there is also a theory that some people, under the laws of war, if you're a prisoner of war, you can be held until the end of hostilities. So if some of these people are defined as prisoners of war, such as the people in Bagram right now, then you can hold them until, for instance, U.S. troops are no longer fighting in Afghanistan. So that's a kind of an indefinite preventive detention that's allowed under the laws of war. So it may be that that's what they're talking about. I don't know. We haven't really seen the details yet. But, you know, there's potential here for this to be, to legitimize some of the worst things in the Bush years. Though I think they've gotten rid of torture and tyranny, which is a certain amount of triumph.
Big. So. Well, I want to open this up to questions, but I have one last question of my own, which is what more work is on your list in your studies of the dark side here? What's at the top of your to-do list? What are the stories that remain to be written about this?
Well, I keep trying to get out of the dark side and into some sort of nice, bright pool of sunlight someplace. So, I mean, there are a couple of shoes that are yet to drop, and they basically are in this area you're talking about of accountability. There is a report that the Obama administration keeps delaying releasing. It's an inspector general's report from the CIA. It was done in 2004. The people who have seen it on the inside say it is truly hair-raising, and it describes the torture programs in a way that was part of what got some people to turn against the torture program inside the government. And I think it would be great if they finally release it. We can, you know, the public can begin to educate itself about what this really was. And so it was supposed to be released tomorrow, but I hear it's delayed again. So I'm waiting to see that. And there's also a report that the Justice Department has done about the Bush lawyers who authorized torture. And the question, it's been a really tricky question, what do you do with lawyers who say that black is white? And is that within the realm of their professional responsibility?
Lawyers who authorize illegal conduct.
Well, I mean, I and say it. It's right, and say that it's legal. And so that
perhaps
report has
be
also
disbarred.
Been...
Perhaps they could be disbarred.
Potentially, though, as a reporter, called up the D.C. Bar Association, which has, you know, a role. Most of these lawyers were licensed in D.C., among other places. And they said that it's almost never that that people are disbarred for taking a particular position in an argument. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but apparently there's sort of no lengths you can argue anything, and it's okay. And anyway, that's what this report is about. So I'm interested in that too.
If anyone in the room has a question for Jane Mayer, we have some microphones here. Do you want to point, or do you want me to point?
You point.
You want
that's
me
fine.
To point?
You pick.
Gentleman here.
Thank you, Jane, for being here. How important is it that we confront this national disgrace in a public manner? And what were on those destroyed CIA torture tapes?
Well, I personally think, as a political reporter covering this, that it's, if you want anything to change, it's incredibly important that the public speaks up about it. Because I've interviewed so many politicians in Washington who say the public doesn't care. And when they feel that, then they aren't going to do anything about it. I mean, and you know, I particularly remember a breakfast with Chuck Schumer, the New York senator, who's a Democrat with a very liberal constituency. And he said, my constituents don't care about this. And so if they feel that, they're not going to do anything about it. So I think that's important. And what's on those 92 tapes? One of the people that I interviewed said that, well, first of all, they were interrogation tapes, and they showed, among other things, the waterboarding of Abu Zubaydah. And one person I interviewed said that they had to be destroyed because if the world ever saw them, the reaction would have been, quote-unquote, unmanageable. So I think they just felt these things were so toxic. And if you think that the still pictures of Abu Ghraib are bad, imagine what videotapes of this looked like. I mean, among the other things that I'm still watching is there's an independent counsel that's doing a criminal investigation about whether the destruction of those tapes amounts to destruction of evidence and obstruction of justice. So there are potential criminal problems coming out of that.
Another hand. Let's see. How about over there in the back?
There's the Geneva Convention. Well, first of all, thank you for the presentation. It was very, very good.
Thank you.
The Geneva Convention has the definition as to what a dictator is, I'm assuming. And then the United States, I'm assuming, would have some kind of legal definition as to what a dictator is based on their actions and non-actions during war. And how would that play into describing what Bush and his cabinet had done in terms of the definition of a dictator that the United States have used through history, what the Geneva Convention has used through history, and does that fit anything along the lines of what Bush has done?
Well, As I've said, I'm not a lawyer, but I think the Geneva Conventions really concern themselves more with the treatment of and conduct of war, and so I don't think that they would define what a dictator is, but it's certainly true that the founding fathers in this country very much carefully divided up the war powers between the Congress and the executive branch in order to make sure that we did not have a monarchical dictator who could start wars, unnecessary wars. And so this country's been designed so that we don't have that kind of concentration of power.
And under the Geneva Conventions, who is liable to prosecution for violations of the Geneva Conventions?
What do you mean, who is liable? I mean, anybody who a grave breach of the Geneva Conventions places you in jeopardy of being prosecuted.
So does this include Addington, Cheney, Bush?
If you can argue that these were grave breaches, I mean, and one of the things that I discovered when I was writing this book was that there was a Red Cross report that actually warned our government that they were in jeopardy of being prosecuted for grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions, because the Red Cross, which is really very much the authority on the subject, found that the treatment of the CIA's prisoners constituted torture. And the Convention Against Torture makes that it's a completely illegal criminal act. So it is possible. I mean, somebody's got to take that action, though. Spain has begun to open up a criminal investigation, as some people may have followed. And they're especially looking at the lawyers.
Okay. About over here. Can we get a microphone on this side? The woman in the second row.
In terms of indefinite detention, one of the groups of people I've worried about at Guantanamo are the people who were in the wrong place at the wrong time, but have been in Guantanamo for 6 years or so, and gotten so radicalized that someone can objectively say, well, they would be a danger now if we let them out because they hate the United States so much. Because has there been any discussion about what you do? Is there such a group, as I would assume there would be? And has there been any discussion of what to do with them?
Well, they're going through this sorting process. That's what one of the things Obama also did was, obviously, he vowed to close Guantanamo within 180 days. And so, I guess within a year, he's got his task forces who are going to report back in 180 days. And so, that is a problem, apparently. What are you going to do with people who've been radicalized against the United States? One of the programs that interests me that that we have tried to put some of these suspects in is a program in Saudi Arabia where they try to, you know, re-educate terror suspects. And among the things that the Saudi Arabians do is they give people the unmarried terror suspects' wives and try to sort of settle them down and...
How's that working?
Well, there have been mixed results. Mostly, actually, they've had a lot of success, but there have been a few sort of notorious cases where people have committed acts, terrorist acts.
No,
after this.
I blame the wives.
It might be the wives, yeah. They've driven people to terrorist acts. So.
Another question. How about right here?
I'm wondering if I'm right that Obama reauthorized the use of, or extended the use of, extraordinary rendition of sin, and if so, can we really say that we don't engage in torture anymore?
They have. What they have done is they, and
that was ordinary rendition.
Rendition. Well, you know. Rendition to justice is what they're calling it. It's basically the program as it was defined in the Clinton administration when they started this program. The notion was that the CIA was going to help pick up terror suspects and deliver them on private jets, it turned out, to other to face justice in various places around the world where
You said this was a Clinton
program.
It began
as a Clinton program, right. So this began as a Clinton program. It was a means of picking people up, extraditing them to face charges in countries where they were wanted. And even in that period, many of the people that were delivered to places like Egypt where they were summarily executed. It was not a pretty situation even then. But we have a law that says that if there's a greater than not chance that someone will be delivered to be tortured, it's illegal to do it. So basically what's happened is now the Obama administration saying, we're still going to help pick up terror suspects, and we're not going to bring them all back to the United States to stand trial. We will, if they're Egyptian, bring them to Egypt, but we will make sure that they're not tortured because it's illegal to deliver them to places to be tortured. So I don't know at this point of any instance of anybody being delivered to be tortured, but you know, it has to be pretty carefully monitored to make sure that they're not, because there are all kinds of places where, you know, they don't live up to sort of due process, obviously. So they're saying they're going to try to do this without torture. We will see.
Now we want to go over here somewhere. Okay, how about in the back row?
When the torture memos were made public this year, there was all this shock and outrage and calls for prosecution and all of that. were you surprised at some of that reaction? Because anybody that read your book would have not been surprised by anything that became public this year, and certainly you and other people that were investigating this have known about a lot of the information in the torture memos for years.
Yeah, there's been this kind of strange Alzheimer's thing that goes on, where basically the stories break, the same story breaks over and over again, and people are shocked over and over again. And I think that maybe it's almost a psychological issue where the country can only absorb so much, it has to be in the right mood to actually focus on this. And early on, I don't think people really wanted to take this in. I mean, really, the Washington Post wrote the first stories about this program, and they were written within a year or two of 9/11, and they were played inside the paper, and nobody responded to it at all, because people really weren't kind of ready to absorb this. But I have to say that those the most recent torture memos, the ones that they released from the Office of Legal Counsel, for aficionados such as myself, there were still some new things in them that were of interest. In particular, the numbers of times that they had waterboarded some of these people, because it seems to violate even the guidelines that the government set up for itself. I mean, they said that they were going to copy of training program where people could be waterboarded in the U.S. military. That program only allows people to be waterboarded twice for 20 seconds. In those memos, you could see that one suspect was waterboarded 183 times. It's so far outside the limits of what anybody understood before that it was fairly shocking, I think, you know, to me too. So.
Well, and the other thing that we've learned more about recently is the extent to which Cheney was sort of pushed away from the center of this towards the end of Bush's second term, that there was a kind of a shift within the White House as more anxieties grew about the potential consequences of these policies.
Well, the CIA itself pulled back from wanting to do these things, which is interesting, because they felt suddenly that they were on shaky legal ground, and they didn't want to see all their people be prosecuted for this. And there were some knockdown, drag-out fights where basically the CIA was refusing to keep doing it. I heard about one, and I've still not been able to get all the details, but it ended with, interestingly, Condi Rice was arguing for the CIA to keep doing this, and the Tenet was refusing to do so, and it ended up with...
Tenet was refusing?
Yeah, because they felt that they were out on too much of a limb legally. So, and the answer was, in fact, that they got more memos that made it safer for them to do the same things. Okay. Thank you.
Let's go in the back. How about in the corner here? Yeah.
Good evening. Thank you very much for your presentation. One reason that Obama may emphasize looking forward and not backward is perhaps America's attitude toward torture and handling of prisoners is more an ideal than real. What we did in the Philippines, the turn of the century, the Jim Crow indentured servants, the 1953 Iran coup, the Phoenix program, Nicaragua, where the World Court actually declared the United States a terrorist nation. Maybe the importance to continue this debate is to really move forward, not look backward, because perhaps our record is not quite as a happy one as you may have indicated earlier.
Well, I think there's a difference. I mean, I get a fair amount of mail from people saying, what about the Phoenix program in particular? I think there is a difference between...
Well, maybe you should just remind us what the Phoenix program was.
The Phoenix program during the Vietnam War, well, you're the historian of some of this era.
They've been writing you about it.
Okay, but but I am not an expert in the Vietnam War. But
So targeted assassinations of named enemies.
Of named enemies. But there and also in South America, the CIA played a role in getting others to do a lot of its dirty work. We basically advised, trained, and to some extent supervised, but they didn't necessarily do all these things themselves from what the history that I have read. What changed, I think, importantly after 9/11, was that for the first time, at least that I know of, the United States, from the very top of our government, authorized the U.S. officially to commit torture and do it ourselves, to hold people in jails of our own making and to carry out a very carefully calibrated, deliberate program of psychological and physical torture, which was described to me by one of the international experts as the most sophisticated program of torture that the world has ever seen. And it wasn't a huge program. Not thousands of people went through it, but for the people who did, it was just total, you know, it just demolished a couple of people and killed a few people and reduced some people like Abu Zubaydah to being, you know, he lives on Haldol now. I mean, these people are in terrible psychological shape. So that's the difference, I think, was that this was an authorized program that we carried out ourselves on purpose, not just sort of in the heat of battle passion.
Okay, so. I've been ignoring this side of the room. How about way over here on this side? People behind me.
I Thank you for your presentation. Are you of the opinion that there will be no Truth Commission on Torture coming from the Congress?
Well, right now the Senate Intelligence Committee is doing its own inquiry. It's not a Truth Commission, but they are actually going through the record on this program. And I think they will put out a report of some sort. Dianne Feinstein is doing this. So it's not that nothing is going on. An actual Truth Commission right now, it seems like unless Obama takes the lead in setting one up, I don't see it necessarily. It's hard to see how it's going to happen. Patrick Leahy has said if Obama won't set it up, he'll conduct his own Truth Commission in the Senate. But again, he's gotten very little support from other senators. So it politically, it just doesn't seem to be happening right now.
Two or three more questions. How about right here?
Thank you. You know, one of the problems, I think, with this really complex issue is that the American public is ambivalent about torture. Mm-hmm. And it seems to my mind that the way we treat our own prisoners in our own prisons is tantamount to torture. The number of people that are in solitary confinement for who knows how long, and the loud music, and I mean a lot of the similar things that you read about in your book and in other reports, I think are going on in American prisons as well. So I think that this is a conversation that needs to be had in this country, and I talk to my friends, and honestly, I don't see a lot of them. People like, who cares? You know, who cares? They're prisoners. They're criminals. They're creeps. It's something that how do we start this conversation and move forward with it in a meaningful way? So I know you have, and thank you, but help us to continue.
Well, you know, there was actually a great piece in The New Yorker that was about solitary confinement very recently. I don't know if you saw it. I think it was by Atul Gawande, which talks about what an incredibly inhumane thing that can be for people. They just, you know, some of these things sound so mundane, but they're really insufferable. You know, I can tell you, though, that I've been looking at polls a lot and what public opinion, where it stands on this issue. And to me, it's bad that there's sort of 50-50 feeling about torture is fairly shocking. But it's not that a majority of people in this country think there should be torture. There's been kind of a misperception that the majority of people think that torture is justified in ticking time bomb situations or something like that. It's actually not. The majority of people are against torture in this country, if you look at all of the polls. And where the opinion is even more completely against torture, it's interesting, is among soldiers in Iraq. And they are the people who you would think would most want to be in favor of it, most likely to be in ticking time bomb situations. They recognize how dangerous it is. If this country embraces torture, then there's really no argument that can be made against using it on them by the enemy. So I just think people need to be educated more. I think for every time Fox puts on, you know, its show 24, there need to be people from West Point saying, this is un-American, it's beneath us, and it's counterproductive, and it's going to endanger our troops. You know, things like that. That's what people need to hear, I think.
It's un-American, and it's beneath us. I think that's a great note to end on. I want to put in a plug here for Library Associates. If you enjoy programs like this one, you can support the Library Foundation. You can do that on your way out tonight. You can sign up. You can throw money in the jar. You can donate your stocks and bonds to the Library Foundation. Thanks to Jane Mayer for her book, and thanks to Jane Mayer for tonight.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.